Welcome to Islands of Resonance, the podcast for people who want to be clear, present, and effective in a challenging world. Together, we explore islands of meaning, models, perspectives, and practices that help you sort through complexity, process world events internally, and find your place in them. In this process, resonance is the inner compass needle that guides us toward greater wholeness. I'm Tobias Klose, sitting here together with my co-host Dennis Wittrock and today's guest, Susan Cook-Reuter. Glad you're here.
Welcome, Susan. Hello. A few words about our guest. Susan Cook-Reuter, one of the most important voices in adult development research. She's widely known for her pioneering work on ego development and for developing the MAP assessment methodology. Her work has shaped how many people think about vertical development, mature meaning making, and the later stages of adult growth. Susan has spent decades studying how adults make meaning, how development unfolds beyond conventional stages, and how language can reveal underlying structures of consciousness. At the same time, she has also been one of the clearest voices cautioning against simplistic, rigid, or inflated uses of developmental models. So this conversation is not only about the promise of ego development theory, but also about its limits, the shadows, and the kind of wisdom needed to use such maps well. Susan, it's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for interviewing me. What I find out about my own thinking, but my own responses, given the dialogue, your questions, that's really one way I learn is by being in dialogue.
Yeah, and maybe to fill in our listeners with a little bit of a backstory, you and me have a little bit of a backstory.
Yes.
I first got to know you in person 2008 in Frankfurt at an event of the newly founded DIA, the German Integral Academy. And back then, I was a new managing director, and you were so kind to serve as our honorary president, if you remember.
I do.
We did a little ceremony, and you also did a workshop there and I remember that back then my son was just born. I brought him.
Yeah.
He's still a baby. You met him during the break, played with him a little bit. And it seemed like he was almost as curious about you as you were about him. And now he's 18 and working on his driver's license. So that's the passage of time, I guess, right here. So it's been a while, but it's great to have you back. Yeah.
Maybe we can start with a simple check-in. Susan, what has been most alive for you recently? In your thinking, your life, or your observation of the world?
The recent accident I had really broke all my expectations and all my sense of what I was going to still do in the professional world. Just from one day to the next, it disrupted it. And that included writing the fable. Mm-hmm. I think I sent you a picture of that as well, that book cover, the guide to it, which were finished but not published, and 2/3 of the final ego development book that I also couldn't finish. And that is really an overview of the developmental field, not just about ego development. So it does explain the theory, its benefits and its drawbacks, and the whole Western biased frame of all developmental theories, including to some degree Ken's.
So this is not yet been published.
Not even finished, and since I can't write.
So I guess we will have to do it in verbally in this podcast. We have an opportunity to capture some of that.
Maybe we can start with you, the human behind this ego development model. So what first drew your interest into ego development or human development itself?
Just human development. I always wanted to be a zoologist or a nature researcher. And in middle school, gymnasium, we learned enough about excellent views of human nature and of language that I suddenly got more interested in thinking, human beings are the most evolved animal because of language. Only because of that, not for any other reason. Since it seems that mentally and emotionally we have not really developed much further in all these centuries. We still have the old, survival instincts and all of that. But then I started to concentrate on language and went to university and all that. Meanwhile, I had to teach because I didn't have any money in order to get to university. And because my sister had Down syndrome, I got certified in teaching special needs children. And of course, that was tough because that's not where my heart was. I mean, it was in one way, but not for a career.
Mm-hmm. So you cared a lot for your sister and you tried to finance your compassion.
It opened my eyes to the diversity of meaningful living. It's not just late stage integral. She was an important person in her surroundings. She was influential in moral judgment because she lived with a lot of people who came from very negative backgrounds and swore, and she always objected to swearing. Just funny things. She was a person that meant a lot to me and from whom I learned a lot.
Yeah, I also grew up with an uncle who had Down syndrome. And I would say to this day, I have never met anyone who was happier or warmly turned toward other people than he was or he still is. So he has almost no sense of time. So there's only this moment and the joyful anticipation of the next one where he will eat some very delicious food or meet somebody he loves.
Yes, but just,
Yeah, there's an immediacy and aliveness about that presence, right? It's just, it's not being tangled up in the great plan of, I'm going to do this or that tomorrow, or it's just very here, right?
Yes, so that was a big lesson, really, from the get-go. And then I had fabulous teacher in gymnasium, really, that... if you want to know, I looked it up because my memory is not so good anymore. But in French class, we read Pascal in the original, Blaise Pascal, Les Pensées. And he said, and that influenced me entirely to describe the construct-aware stage. He actually said, qu'est-ce que l'homme dans la nature? Un néant l'égard de l'infini, un tout à l'égard de néant. Un milieu entre rien et tout.
Please translate.
I don't speak French.
French. Our teachers weren't as good as yours. So
in
translation.
Short, it says human beings are a mixture between, or compared to the universe, they're nothing, a drop in the ocean. Compared to nothingness, they're everything. They are a universe. And they're bridging between nothing and everything.
So it's kind of this intermediate position and the order of things, one could say.
And the tension, the paradox of being both, which is so quintessential for the construct-aware stage.
So that was kind of a seed that also kind of for you that blossomed later when you described that particular stage.
because it had such an impact on my understanding of life when we actually read it and discussed it.
That's great. So that was Switzerland, right? So you grew up
in Switzerland.
Yeah. And then you went to the US
in 76.
And to study
linguistics. To get married.
I
went to the USA in 68 to a college in Los Angeles to study English literature, basically.
Mm-hmm. So language was also a big interest of yours?
Yes. I translated Beowulf into modern English, and the teacher was really impressed because it was not my native tongue. But I haven't had enough linguistic training to be able to do it, and the curiosity too. I first was in Los Angeles in the food department, and I hated it because the students were so not frugal. They took several steaks and then ate only one, and I just couldn't stand it. I came from a relatively poor background. That to me was just disgusting. And then I got into the computer lab because I knew how to program. We had those big machines with things you had to make holes into. And if you made one mistake, the computer would spit out the whole thing. And I just could laugh. I mean, it's just,
interesting.
So I was always interested in math, in other things other than just language and human beings.
And from programming and language, you entered this field of analyzing in a programmatic way language for the developmental space.
That could have been part of it, to realize that the meaning behind language, that's something I learned at university, to look at that. So semantics was really an important part of my training. Yes, and to see the changes over time in languages in terms of meaning and new vocabulary and all that.
Yeah.
And
in our first conversation, you mentioned how deeply grateful you are for the teacher, not just the one from the gymnasium, as well then for the later ones. You told us about Jane Lovinger and your Dr. Father Keegan as well. How did you met them, and how was your relationship?
In 78, I took a course at Harvard with Keegan. No, it wasn't Keegan. You have to forgive my mental lapses because that's one of the issues with brain damage that sometimes it is fired. I met a teacher and a course on adult development, and among other theories that existed back then, the teacher introduced Lovinger, and it was like marriage in heaven. She uses language to assess people's human meaning making. So I immediately learned how to score and took to the theory. And as soon, it really was a miracle in some ways, a godsend. As soon as I start scoring, I got a few responses that could not be explained with her theory or with her manuals. But they made sense to me. Ever late stage. And so when I told her about it, she said, "You are in the stratosphere. Nobody can understand that. If you think you do, you are suffer from hubris."
Welcome to the club.
Anyway, I didn't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was a beautiful person, incredibly well read, and could lecture beautifully, but I also thought that was a limitation of hers, that she could not understand the later stages. So I just kept going, and I started to collect those responses. The two I had were not enough to make a theory, so every time I scored tests for somebody else. I asked whether I could keep, if there were any, which there really are, whether I could keep them for my own research. And people said, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1985, I had enough to have a theory and to present it at a symposium.
How much was enough? Like what was the number of
I count at least 1,000.
1,000 late stage
tests.
Or?
No, just tests.
Tests
and
in
among
general. Okay.
Those, there were enough
okay.
Late stage responses. So mm-hmm. I could actually see some patterns and make some categories. How they are different, even within the stage, what would be indicative of that later meaning making.
The just for some listeners who might not know, what's the genius of this methodology invented by Jane Levenger? How exactly does one measure a stage by using language? How does it work?
So the test, the original sentence completion test, had 36 stems, sentence beginnings, like my father, raising a family, a good boss, etc., etc. 36 different ones that tap into different aspects of being a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people just have to finish the prompt. And there are lots of rules, you know, you can't just go on and write whole paragraphs and things like that, that in other tests are allowed, in sentence completion tests they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And the rules of how combined sentences and all of that. And then you read each one and you compare it to a manual that has a description of the stage, the particular stem, like raising a family. It has categories. It's separated by stages and each stage has subcategories. And then you try to, if you get a sentence from somebody, you try to match it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can, then there are rules about, you know, how to go about it.
So there's kind of pre-existing answers that match or mostly like if it's a...
Early ones match. Often later ones, of mm-hmm. course, are unique and
okay.
don't match.
Okay,
all.
And she...
Then you need to...
So she developed this for how many stages? Like five or so?
Up to five, stage five.
And you kind
What's
of added...
What's called integral.
You kind of added... two or three more, or you found data for
I
more?
Added, yes, mm-hmm. I distinguished the her later stage. I separated into two.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't think it was the best way to describe human development. And what's interesting is, and I think it's important to think about all stages, our Western stages are progressive and linear. They go onward and upward,
mm-hmm.
with higher being the best.
Yep.
And I've never subscribed to that. I use it as for certain aspects of ego development, but the overall arc is actually an arc.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a good place to show it.
Right. So you sent us this. Let's show it here for those who are just listening to us and not watching. What are we seeing here?
Well, it says the title is Stages of Ego Development from Knowledge to Wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an arc there that starts on the left with the self-centric stage, then group-centric, skill-centric, and self-determining.
Mm-hmm.
Self-determining is at the apex of this curve. It means that the human being at the stage four or self-determining has reached the optimal or the maximal capacity that is described in the conventional Western mindset.
Mm-hmm.
It's the progressive one, it's the scientific one,
it's modern.
Modern is another word mm-hmm. for it, yes. And it's the one that most of our systems teach. Even universities teach stage four. If they teach a bit more the questioning, the green or the 4 or 5 stage, human beings tend to then fall back into 4 as soon as they enter the workplace, because that's where the meaning making is being made.
So the collective stage is kind of a bit of a magnet that kind of pulls you back, or if you go beyond it, one could say.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my observation. So even universities of course teach questioning, but then and more, you know, diversity and all of that, but then that gets sort of washed out again when you go back to when you enter the workforce. Mm-hmm. Not only are you usually young, and the older generation doesn't like to be challenged in that way, and so there are few. You can see the picture is also separated into 2 halves. On the left side is conventional and linearism, and that comprises about 80 to 85% of all people who've ever tested.
Comprises or compromises? It's kind of... but it could be both.
I misspoke. Comprises.
Comprises, yeah, yeah. But also...
It also compromises when, if you will.
Yeah,
it is a limit. It does not allow for people to see the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So we can say both compromised.
So maybe before mm-hmm. we go deeper into the arc and the stages itself, we're talking about vertical development, especially now.
That's now a misnomer. It's so common and it's so fashionable, but it's actually a misnomer.
So how would you describe it now? With not vertical, but circular? Or how?
Well, circular, yes. I used to have what I called the cosmic egg. So you have evolution and then involution back to the beginning, a circular mm-hmm. kind of movement, which is much closer to nature and what's actually happening. In the big, mm-hmm. really big picture, you have negentropy, evolution, and you have negentropy.
Entropy and negentropy, yes, yes.
Yeah, entropy is the negative. It's going de-evolution, if you will.
Yeah, entropy, yeah. Yeah, the heat death of the universe, and then the universe kind of springing forth out of nothingness or whatever, where everything comes from, and unfolding life and all the complexity, and then contracting again.
And we know in the end the universe and the sun and all of that will also, you know, be gone, mm-hmm. devolve.
But in between we're human and we do we do our thing, and we try to make sense of the world. And so we have a model, your model, that can help us with that. And you say it's not vertical, but so you kind of
circular.
Answered one question we had, how your view of vertical development changed over the years. So you don't view it as vertical in per se anymore, right? Is that what he's saying?
I would say that even so, one can describe certain aspects of it, mm-hmm. like the relationship to time or the relationship that humans have with each other. You can demonstrate with a spiral as it gets broader and broader, my relationship to others. Whereas in the beginning, it's just to myself, and I use others at the self-centric stage. They're only there to satisfy my whims and wishes. At the very late stages, I'm one with everything. I don't separate. And that's the second part of the illustration as well. But the first half, I build a self, a separate mm-hmm. self, unique self.
Mm-hmm.
That's the effort that we do. In the second half, I slowly deconstruct that separation. I realize I'm actually not separate. I realize at 4 or 5, at the first stage, after the middle, that I have been programmed by my language and by my culture in seeing the world in a particular way. Mm-hmm. That allows me then to also recognize that others have been suffering from the same constraints. Their worldviews are also limited and equally varied. That's the new wrinkle there.
Yeah.
I can recognize that diversity is actually something positive.
So the suffering comes, so kind of we all suffer from this language-induced delusion of
yes.
the self that we have to build, first of all, and then protect and defend against death, or try to find some, I think Ken Wilber once called it an Atman project. So a project to, you know, become Atman, or to make yourself eternal, to defeat death, like kind of like building the pyramids. Or I think Ernest Becker has this book on denial of death, I think it's called.
Yes,
it's just
the
just to
power of Bible yes. is a good example. Yes.
Just to get over, or to cover over, yeah, the truth of our ultimate, I mean, that we ultimately have to die as human beings, which is kind of tragic from some perspective, but maybe also natural from some other perspective, right?
And the blessing, yes.
And the blessing, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
When we mm-hmm. would sit now in a room full of... Yeah, conventional managers, and we would talk about this kind of circular development, call it like this, then it would be probably still a very fringe topic for most of them that is not very well understood in the mainstream.
It is not, and we know why, because it really challenges the norms. The fundamental norms that are taught throughout business, throughout the world, through our capitalism, throughout everything, in such a way that the challenge is dangerous for people almost.
Yeah, it challenges the ego. That's what it does.
Well, that yeah. too, right. If people are even aware that they have an ego, because they generally have a self at stage four. An identity, a well-defined, clear identity with boundaries. I'm this, not that. I'm this person, not this kind of person. That is very clear.
Yeah.
But to get beyond that, to think that we're fundamentally human beings, no matter what culture. And I have actually, the last, I would say now, 15 years, tried to... share that idea with people like at the individual IDGs, you know,
the inner development goals. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because there was, as beautiful as the research was, it was completely not even. It didn't even include Switzerland. It only included the northern small states.
Mm-hmm.
And so the values were very narrowly focused, whereas there are, of course, totally different values in different cultures,
mm-hmm.
particularly indigenous cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of challenged that. I tried to challenge things in a friendly way. Just mm-hmm. pointing out that there is possibly another perspective.
Yeah, now we are jumping to a topic, one shadow of the integral world, or the shadow of developmental models, that they're just so focused on Western cultures in the Northern Hemisphere, and that it's not a proof that this can be assumed for cultures all over the world, right?
Exactly, and particularly indigenous cultures who are in many ways much further away, further ahead than we are. We eventually come to the realization that we're part of everything, that we're not separate from nature, that the animal parts of us are still functioning mm-hmm. quite well.
Mm-hmm.
They teach the little children that they're not separate. The whole agriculture is based on an exchange with nature, that if I take, I give, not just taking.
What would you reply to people who say, "Oh, you're romanticizing indigenous cultures"? I mean, they're just not as complex.
Of course, like in our culture, there, as we say, at least 80% of people are not very complex thinkers. But in our culture, there is 10, 15, 20% maybe of people who can see the bigger picture. And in indigenous cultures, there are usually shamans or people with special knowledge about herbs, about the cycle of the seasons, about all kinds of things, that have very deep knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Also about what's below and above in terms of being connected to ancestry. And it's just not true. It's just misinformation. And that comes also from the Western explorers, that in the early anthropologists, of course, saw everything through their own filter of Western progression.
Right.
And devalued, actually, what they could have noticed.
Right. So,
yeah.
You want to...
We're talking now... We're talking now about culture. That's very, very interesting. But maybe we can come back first to ego development. Maybe for listeners who may... not know the term in the substance, what does your ego development model actually try to describe?
It describes the growth from childhood, but especially looking at adults, from early ways of making sense of life, from what we call self-centric, which the term self explains, that you can't see anything beyond your own self and your own needs, to a way more mature appreciation of what it means to be a human being, which is all its criticisms, is all its recognizing our foibles, our tendency to value our own ideas more than those of others, all of that. And that can be described in a progression of stages.
Mm-hmm. And with it comes a development of perspectives. That's
that's
methodology
one of them.
You added for the development of space.
More perspectives, including a perspective, again, at the almost late stage, a perspective on one's own meaning-making, a recognition that we are bound to be storytellers. So in some ways, I would sometimes describe the stages as different stories, coherent stories about what life is like, what others are like, what I am like, and what's important to me, what I value.
So when I look in my interiors, where do I find the stage? How do I find my stage? How do you discover these?
That's the thing. Nobody is at a stage.
Uh-huh.
Never was, never is.
Well, how do I discover my range of stages, if I can?
Oh, you can take a test. You can take the MAP test. MAP standing for maturity assessment profile or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And for... Well, since Löwenger and since I started with this thing, we have used this test. It is expensive. It is involved because you have to be highly trained, usually doctorate level psychology, to even be able to analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and now we have wonderfully a AI version of it.
Okay. I think that's a topic we wanted to touch upon anyway. So just before we go there, so you're saying direct introspection is not the method to find out which stage you are, likely.
No, and that's a problem, I would say, sometimes with the integral folks, because they understand, because they have read about it, later stages, they then feel they're already there because they seem to understand it intuitively, have a sense for it. Whereas when you actually test them, they often are still conventional, but they can talk about what I call aboutism. We can all talk about things that we have learned, but we haven't internalized.
Or is it akin to learning a language and being able to understand it without being able to productively kind of speak it, like produce like content in it? Like, oh, yeah, I get it.
I'm not sure that parallel works.
Okay. Just an idea.
It's more like integral informed cognitively, but not embodying
that's
it.
That's the important word. So there is quite a number of developmental theories that look at the complexity, cognitive complexity. And that's just one small aspect of being a human being. As we already started this conversation, a person like my sister or your cousin or whoever, what was it, can be meaningful for a whole bunch of people, for a whole community, and not be cognitively very complex at all. Retarded, seriously challenged that way with a very low IQ. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And you can have a very high, a low IQ and be very powerful, as we also know.
Yes, we
shall
do.
Not go into detail on that. But
those who shall be named here. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So when we put this, if we use this insight and put this together with your model, could somebody be or has a perspective, for example, the fourth perspective cognitively, but not completely embody it in the
Absolutely.
Whole life?
And you can be just pure IQ smart and therefore play in with all the theories. And yet as a human being, you are not a fully developed whole human being. Your emotional intelligence may seriously suffer. Your compassion, all of that may be lacking.
Mm-hmm.
It can still be, and that's, again, we say that narcissism, not natural, human narcissism can go from all the way up, not necessarily clinical, but natural self-preservation and the need to feel good about oneself and therefore to shape reality in such a way and your story that you come out as a great person.
Mm-hmm. So you are referencing different lines of development and ego development, and the capacity to take different perspective is just one.
Yes, it's just one. And ego development really says it's a mixture, or it's tapping into actually the test different aspects: behavioral, emotional, and cognitive.
Mm-hmm.
All of them get tapped into and assessed, not just the cognitive.
So it's really a kind of a system, a whole system that moves kind of upwards, let's say, in the metaphor here, a certain ladder of complexification and becoming more encompassing over time. Could we say that?
And that is part of what we can say about the later stages. They are indeed more capable of seeing complexity and paradox and be at ease with it. They can see the differences starting with stage 5 or what we call integral. Mm-hmm. You can see that other people are actually necessary, that you need all of humanity in order to talk about human beings, not just those who have evolved to a certain level. At least that's my understanding. And you can gain greater love and compassion and wisdom for the way things are, rather than how you dream they should be.
Yeah, I reread one of your papers here before the call, and it struck me that there's an increase of compassion and understanding at the later stages, because you can kind of, there's less resistance against the way things are, it seems.
Yes.
So it's almost as if the earlier stages always have a denial of reality and so, or some aspect of reality they don't like to they don't like to acknowledge, or that we all have to die, for example, which is not so nice to acknowledge, and they kind of push it away, or that they may not be the best at something, and then they kind of cover it over, or they want others to be other than they are, or want them to be more evolved, kind of a pitfall of the
yes.
later stages, like of the integral stage. Oh, why can't we pull on the grass to make it grow like faster? All right. So, but
that's your theory. Yes.
Yeah. Does it work?
Oh no, I accept just the last bit. Yes, we can't do that to make grow. However, I also feel that becoming familiar with theories, developmental theories, can be a lever. It mm-hmm. can help you see what might be possible.
Yeah.
Now, it's not just a matter of wanting to get there, which is sometimes the mistake people make, but it is helping to notice when you look around, this person actually embodies some of that later stage, for instance. How do they operate? How are they different from how I am now? So you could learn by having a model that's a little bit later than you, not all the way. But you can learn from others who are further along the way.
When you listen to these descriptions of higher stages, like you're more passionate, you have more compassion, you can understand more, it can help you, and so on and so forth, one could assume higher stages are better. So maybe we can look at what are the downsides maybe of later stages. Are
well,
there any disadvantages?
It is, unfortunately, both in theoretically, it ignores the fact that they're only looking at Western later stages. They don't actually have a theory or a sense of what later stage would mean in other cultures, indigenous cultures, where I absolutely am convinced they have something to offer that is later, that there are also progressions in their cultures, and that some people inhabit a different kind of worldview than the most of the people at that in that particular tribe or culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the train of my thought. Remind me, what was your question?
My question was if there are any disadvantages or downsides of the later
yes.
stages.
Okay. Well, the thing that Lovinger complained about me, it could be hubris.
Mm.
The sense that if I know so much, look at me, how wonderful, how great I am. How insightful, how compassionate, and to use that as a badge of honor. To
arrogance.
Oneself with that as self-affirmation.
How did you navigate that? Well, you were the pivotal researcher doing all that stuff. So did you fall prey to
I'm
that?
Not... Yes, I'm also accept, and that's another thing that later stage is an advantage. I notice much quicker. I notice almost in the moment.
That makes you better, or what?
Later stages do when I fall into that trap.
Oh yeah, that makes you really better.
I have the desire to feel better than I am, or to
yeah.
think I know more than you do, or any of that. It isn't. That time lapse between not seeing it at all, starting to see it, but maybe several hours or days later, and you could look back and say, oh my God, how did I do that? You know, look at what I accomplished. And then later, when it's very short, immediate, when you feel that way, when it comes up in you, when it arises, you immediately can say, oh no, that's not right.
Yeah, that reminds me of that's
I'm a nothing compared to the universe.
Right, so the Pascal's other side, right? Reminds me of that story where, you know, there's this guy falling into a hole and like walking on the street and falling into a hole and like, oh damn, I didn't see that. Next day he comes by and then he sees, oh, there's a hole, I'm gonna fall into that, and he's falling into that. And the next day he's coming by, is like, oh, there's the hole, I'm gonna walk around it, right? So this progression of, oh, I don't have to fall into the hole anymore. I can see it coming, but I still have to I still fall in there. Yes. But the next time I just already I'm aware. So
and that helps then to get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Right.
It doesn't mean I don't occasionally feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when your body starts falling apart and you're very close to not being here anymore, then you hold on in some ways. I'm just speaking about myself, to the things you still can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I see a quote here that I wanted to share with all of you. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it. When the time comes to let it go, to let it go. And that's a quote from Mary Oliver. And I actually moved further than letting it go, which I have to do anyway, to letting it be, is my current question. What does it mean to let it be? It's a lot of letting go, obviously, but letting it be, that's what I'm really wondering about. What does that mean?
That's the wisdom of somebody who's been decades in the field of development.
Yeah, or just...
And still has questions.
Yes.
I think my main characteristic that I would describe about myself is curiosity and the level, some courage as well, but mostly just endless curiosity.
Yeah. So you said you're in a stage in your life where, yeah, obviously the mortality comes to mind, and the frailty of aging, and so how do you navigate this terrain? So does your research you've done, is that a resource for you that helps you navigate that process?
I presume so, because I can shift perspectives relatively readily, easily. So I can find comfort even with people who I in the past might have avoided. I'm part of this Council on Aging, where all the local, you know, the village type old people get together, and I'm probably the only one who thinks the way I do. I don't even introduce it, but I find comfort to hang out with them and to give them comfort as well. And we discuss what we call the... what do we call it? The organ recital.
The organ recital.
It's a double meaning. You know, I'm Orgelspiel,
Recitation.
Mm-hmm. But organ recital, of course, means all the things that are wrong with us. All the pains, all the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, I get it. No, I get it. Mm-hmm.
And there you... And I saw that also when I was for a month in the retirement village, because I needed to recover.
Uh-huh.
There's a connection on that level with everybody. And when you suffer, there is no difference, no matter how educated you are and how, you know, your cognitive capacity is there. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that interesting that suffering is the great connector in some ways? Like it equalizes,
yes.
It equalizes us, like in a way. Yeah, I suffer, you suffer. You want to be happy, I want to be happy. That's so
yes.
simple in a way, right? So,
yes,
no,
that is a very good connector, actually, because it invokes compassion. Compassion meaning feeling with others. Yeah.
Yes. Often when developmental models are explained in workshops, I observe that participants initially tend to pigeonhole others. Especially it comes with spiral dynamics and they color code categories. You know, this person is orange, that sentence was blue, and so on and so forth.
That is especially strongly matter of spiral dynamics with the simplification of cause. I don't know, did you see my keynote for the Integral European Conference?
Yes, I did.
Because that is, and it's now also a problem with Ken's theory, since he took the color scheme, it leaves out one of the most common stages, the one on the curve there that's called 3-4, the skill-centric. It doesn't have it. It jumps from amber to orange in one fell swoop. This is absolutely not reflecting the development of human beings. It is a good model for the development of civilization. And, you know, Gebser was one of the first to mention that. And he's also a Swiss, which, see there, I'm just a wee bit proud.
Mm-hmm. Some cultural bias here.
Gebser, and Arber, all Swiss.
Oh, well, Gebser was actually from Posen. Or was it?
But he lived his main life
in the end,
in Switzerland and his work. Yes.
True.
And he took Swiss citizenship, as far as I know. Anyway, that's one of those things where you say, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of pride. And why not? That's also human.
Yeah,
so you're becoming more forgiving to your own foibles, to your own predilections, because you notice them. And you can say, okay, that's not hurting anybody. It's just that kind of, yes.
So how should one use your model?
Lightly.
Like, in small doses.
If it helps, if one is really curious about where one is individually, then take a test. You can, as we said, you can now take it even on the... in an AI version, which is quite different from mine, but I support it strongly.
So that
you're talking about the version from Lily and Tamás?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
They used only data from me, sentence completion data, and they developed, and I vetted them carefully before I chose to go with them. There are others who do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they found, because they had the data and they looked at it without the filters that I use, the criteria, they found new patterns. So that's intriguing, particularly when you use it in coaching.
What patterns did they find? They didn't find new stages, did they?
No. The stages are fairly well come out, you know, very high percentile of agreement. No, there's new ways of things to emphasize or to pick out of a test to say, this is where you have the most leverage if you focus on this aspect of your meaning making.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you are most likely to make progress.
So you support the so we first established that doing a test is pretty laborious and it needs to be done by scored by really skilled people who are really highly trained.
Yes,
and that is a bit of a burden or a bit of a hurdle to for the average person to just take such a test. So now we have AI models that might be able to do something similar or come to a result faster,
cheaper,
mm-hmm.
and so therefore more democratic. It was never democratic because it takes so much money.
Mm.
So maybe we had, when I worked with companies, maybe the leadership team took it.
Mm-hmm.
But you could never have it for a whole, you know, organization with all the levels. That was just not reasonable.
It might lead to more people getting test results, let's say.
And the support, the coaching that goes with it.
Yeah, okay. I was just about to say, because left alone with such, it's kind of like, oh, this is the verdict. This is who I am.
You can't take the test just for, it is combined with
the coaching.
Debrief.
Yeah.
Which
okay,
is
I get
a
it.
Coaching
okay.
debrief.
So it's not just, you can't just go online and buy it somewhere and, you know,
nope.
Take it home. Okay.
No, that would be, irresponsible. That would be, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. So okay, we also had a question related to usage of such methodology or such models in the workplace, because some employers might find this attractive to say, oh, I can, you know, hire for that, or I can, you know, hire for the job. So what do you think of that? Or what is there?
Well, have to be an achiever if you want to have
it. It's actually illegal
in
the United States, unless it's part of a battery.
Battery of tests, or what do you mean?
Yes, you can't just take that test and make a decision based on that.
Okay.
So many other things are equally important for, you know, filling a position.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of akin to saying, oh, my level of development is all that is you need to know about me, which is, I mean, there's so many variables of a human being that like IQ, I mean, back then everybody got reduced to IQ, and then we found out, oh, well, wait a minute, there's like multiple intelligences. Howard Gardner said, okay, we have got all these lines of development, and EQ, by the way, is very important, and interpersonal skill, and
all of it.
The culinary line of development.
Mathematical capacity, all of it is part of, and I actually wait to have a book published by the Fielding Institute on DEI, diversity,
equity and inclusion.
Yes, because I wrote a chapter there that looks at humanity from what we all have in common, and how we differ uniquely from each other. That's all I wrote. There's a whole chapter on that. And then it hasn't come out yet, but I hope it will.
So what is it that we have in common, and where do we differ? Does it have to do with
the need for meaning making, the fear of death, for instance, that is common. The way we differ in personality types,
mm-hmm.
the way we are being brought up from childhood, the environment makes a difference. There's lots and lots of other differences as well. Different theories about it. If you think of astrology, for instance, or the Enneagram, or other, there are other things that tap into how human beings are different.
Right. So these are all kind of lenses for describing patterns
of differences. We explain each other with these differences, and what we have in common, we are born whether we want to or not, so the happenstance of birth, and we have to die. So far, I don't think there will ever be an exception, because nature,
we're working on that. We're uploading ourselves to the cloud.
And then the cloud will disappear as well. And it's
the cloud of unknowing.
It's those kinds of things we have in common. We have bodies with its needs. We need food and shelter. We need other people to even get to adulthood. If we are born and left alone, nothing up, you know, we die. We need ways to communicate. And those, again, differ wildly, but we all need them. So that's what we have in common. There's more and more. You should read the chapter when it finally, the book finally comes out. It really is a good overview of how we, many, many, many ways we differ. The teachers we've had, the time of, the period of in historical time we live in makes a difference. All of it.
Oh, it's just interesting. I just read an article about my mini generation. The people born that had didn't grow up with the internet yet. So I was born 78. So I play with computers, okay, but we didn't have the internet. And then in my youth, the internet. So I got to experience a youth without the internet and all the social media and all that stuff that.
Yeah.
I would say poisons people's minds these days. And then later I got to, I was not so old to not be able to get into that later in my life. So I feel kind of blessed to have had a childhood that was relatively, free of those influences. And, you know, it was, now these days I'm able to read a book, and I doubt that this skill is present in many young people these days, but who, yeah, it just came into being at a certain period of time historically without their doing, you know, where there were smartphones, and you know, it's hard to avoid those things. And yeah, that does something to you.
And I feel I'm born right in 45, right after the Second World War ended. And I feel now, because of my age, often like a dinosaur. I just cannot. All the stacks and all the ways people now communicate meaningfully, but I just can't figure these things out.
Well,
I have to ask the groups I'm part of, I have to say, please send me an email. You know, with the, it's impossible to keep on top of all of this.
Well, I think you're doing
fascinating thing.
You're doing well.
My grandchildren can do it. They can just manipulate everything already. They could, when they were 2 and 3, they could already look at their little, you know, pads and play games on it. It's a different world, and what concerns me, I guess, is that this change is far more than any changes in human history ever before. There have been major transitions, you know, Kuhn's work and all that, but not that drastic.
How would you describe our current situation when you say this? Is it a drastic change or a drastic transformation that's ahead of us, or
I'm not sure yet. That's a part of the issue for me, is I don't understand it. I have a visceral sense of it, but I don't really have the mind to comprehend it, to have a big picture view of it. I know they're different. They're the more positive, again, the integral ones. It's just a wrinkle, and it's just a period of darkness, and then the light will come out. I'm not so sure.
No.
I think we may be on the way of the demise of humanity, not just humanity, of
the planet, right?
Earth as a system, mm-hmm. as a whole,
mm-hmm.
the way we're going, the closest we are to atomic wars, and it just, if you look around, there's not much hope I can find in the big picture.
Well, that's a great way to end the podcast.
No, it's not.
We're not.
On that very hopeless note, I see myself as I'm an agnostic, and I'm realistically looking at things.
Yeah.
And to say a positive thing, there is joy. there is joy in nature. There is joy even in a beton world. You can find little things. You can find a sparrow that built a nest in a lamppost. You can find little things that are just fine and give you joy. And that's
and
what
for this,
I mean.
You don't need to be at level XYZ.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
Thank goodness you don't.
Yeah. I think a lot of that sense is also that we were steeped in media and we're steeped in information, and that is often not our present reality where we are looking out of the window. Let's say if I look at here, it looks pretty peaceful, but you know, the Iran war and Ukraine war and all the, you know, the drama on the world stage, it's there too in some way, but only if I pay attention to it, obviously, right? So, but there's also a local reality where there's sanity, you know, and to some degree.
Yeah, so again, it's where do we focus our attention and do we find the balance? Because we don't want to just numb ourselves to the realities of the external world either. But can we find, and that would be, my main coaching method too, is to where do you find joy? Where do you find things in your life that make meaning to you, that make you feel fine about being alive?
Is this the first hint for the second half of the circular development? When do you scribe the other way of the arc back?
Well, maybe, and also just for being able to survive, which is part, I don't know, but it seems to be, we can't help it. Once we're born, we need to, there is part of us that wants to stay alive. That's also true in the animal world.
Yeah.
And how can we do this meaningfully is by finding things that make us feel good. So at the earlier stage, it may be your family that is everything to you. You don't think beyond, but you're really a fine grandparent, for instance, or a fine parent for your children. That's a small world, but it's still fine.
So focus on your...
You have to worry about more things. You talked about drawbacks of later. It's that you worry a lot more about many more things because they come on your radar. You can't avoid them.
Yeah. Susan, what do you hope will happen with your work in the future and what impact will it maybe
have?
Well,
I'm glad for the artificial intelligence use of it. I trust that several people I've trained do it in an ethical way, that are not just concerned with the bottom line and how much money they can make with it. I trust there are enough people who seem to understand it well enough and can play with it and make new theories out of it, or new paths that they find when they use it. That would be my hope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that seems to be like a fulfilling state of the life work, isn't it?
It is. I feel very blessed. It's not been easy.
Yeah.
But in the long run, I look back and I'm serene and happy about it.
Yeah. Well, do you have an advice as an elder to the younger generation facing all this crisis we talked about?
Balance between being realistically assessing what's happening and finding joy in whichever way you do. So a balancing act, and just saying yes to life. To be, to accept what is without wanting it to be different, and practice that attitude.
And maybe without wanting to enter a new stage of development, or?
Well, you can do it anywhere, yes. To be kind, to be compassionate, to all of those things which don't necessarily need late development. They are very good people at earlier stages and very not so good ones at later, I'm afraid.
Oh, well.
Right, right.
Okay. Do you have any more questions, Dennis?
Yeah, one just occurred to me. What does Susan Gugreuter do for a spiritual practice? Do you have one, or is it a topic for you?
Nature is my main.
So you're teacher. a nature mystic.
I'm in a sangha, in a Zen sangha. I unfortunately can't do yoga anymore because I just can't move or stand up or anything without
support. Hand yoga.
Yeah, you can do lots of yoga still.
Yes, I can still do
yoga
that.
Nidra.
So the limitations that way, but overall, I'm content.
Hmm.
I've had so many experiences, good and bad, in between.
All right.
Okay.
I can only wish the younger generation that you find some sort of equanimity in all the messes and in the poly crises and all of the stuff we're dealing with.
Yeah. It's sorely needed.
Hope for the best. Yes.
Yeah. Well, hope is a good thing. Love is a good thing.
Yeah.
It says so in the Bible.
Comes down to the simple
many
things.
Many Bibles,
yeah.
Oh. Okay, Susan, thank you very much for this rich and also thoughtful conversation. And thank you as well for your extraordinary contribution to the field of adult development for so many years. I think your work has influenced and inspired many people. And yeah, today it's been a real privilege to speak with you. So
you.
I
enjoy sharing a little bit of whatever I have learned through all these years.
Yeah, wonderful. I would like to make a short check out. Maybe we can start with you, Dennis. What idea resonated the most for you in this conversation?
What resonated the most? Well, in the end, I had a sense that it comes down to the simple things in life, being kind, you know, being compassionate. And all the other stuff is great if you are, you know, smart and intelligent and you see complex systems and whatnot. Well, that's super. But only insofar it helps you to be kind. And because otherwise, you could also abuse it, right? So there's all these capacities. So in the end, simply be kind. And the realization that suffering can be a connector, something that shows you how interconnected you are to other beings, and that we are not so different in many important ways, even though we're unique and special, and that's great too. But those ideas and that resonated, and just the quality of your being with us, the whole flow of the conversation, that kind of, there's something you hear between the lines. It's kind of when I talk to you, and I really appreciate that, and thanks for making the time. Well, that's my resonance. But
yeah,
how about you, Toby?
Yes, stages doesn't matter. And they matter. That was the first one.
Yes, and is important. Polarity.
Yeah. And it is important to note that typical development models focus solely on individual development, especially in Western cultures of the Northern Hemisphere, and that the stages especially the higher ones, may look like quite different in other countries, in other cultures and countries. Yeah. So thank you very much, Susan. What idea resonated most for you? Any last message?
Just as I said initially, before we even started, I enjoy dialogue with younger people, with people from other cultures, just to stimulate my own being. And because I'm so isolated where I am now, I can't drive, I can't go anywhere without help. So the internet is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wished I could be with you, but I can't. So this is a pretty good substitute.
Yeah, I feel like you are in a way. I feel you pretty present here.
So that's my take. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to be.
We're honored to have you,
Toby, and to be back in touch with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that fills my heart with joy.